Hi guys, Ringside Ramblers back with a big interview and a special interview for me tonight. This guy, you know guys, I've been a wrestling fan since 85 and every week on TV, like I said before, 12 o'clock noon, watch Tony Schiavone, David Crockett do a worldwide wrestling, then 11:30 at night, you stay up at 11:30 at night on WRL, you watch Bob Caudle and Johnny Weaver doing the NWA Pro shows. So when I finally got to go to a live event, the first match I saw at the old Dorton Arena, and it was on July 30th, 1986, was this guy against one of the Thunderfoots. And, you know, that really kicked off everything for me. I've been to several live events since then, but you always remember that first match. But with me today is former NWA, WCW, USWA, a little bit of everywhere superstar, Mr. Todd Champion. Welcome to the show, Mr. Champion.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Good. Going good. Like I said, thank you so much for doing this. Quite an honor to be able to talk to you today. Like I said, my first live match was that one with the Thunderfoot. We talked about that a little bit before we came on the air. And the old Dorton Arena, boy, do I miss those days. They were some great times back then.
I'll tell you what, it was a different era. You know, and I was coming in the mid-late 80s when wrestling was really starting to skyrocket nationally. Now, you know, the sport used to be a regional sport.
Right.
And then you had, then the cable gets involved and all these things, and then it becomes national. So I kind of came in the beginning of all that and had some great memories with, you know, riding up and down the road, you know, with guys like the Rock and Roll Express and Jimmy Valiant and all those guys, you know, and just telling good stories. I had a blast, man. I don't regret it a bit.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about growing up. Were you a wrestling fan? I know you were a football fan, but were you a wrestling fan growing up?
I was born in Concord, North Carolina.
Oh yeah,
and I lived there in China Grove till I was 13 years old, and we moved to California. So I really wasn't. I'd heard wrestling, but I was more of a football kid. I was a three sport guy all the way through school. And so wrestling really wasn't on my radar. It just kind of happened by accident, really.
So football, you were, you know, I've seen some of your promos, your USWA promo where you made all the, had all the helmets, the National Fitness Award and all that stuff. Football, when you superstar through high school, what schools were after you? You know, you end up going to Utah State. But what schools were talking to you about playing football for them?
I probably had 35 scholarships.
Wow.
I was kind of what you call a late bloomer. I was always a quarterback and a running back, and one day I started growing and getting bigger. And I always tell people I kind of ate my way into a 3-point stance, you know? You know, so by the time I was in high school out in California, in Los Angeles, I was about 6'5", about 240. You know, then, of course, went on up to Utah State, and I don't know if this name rings a bell. You ever heard a guy named Rod Marinelli?
Yeah. I've done my research on you about that. You played with some great guys, and that was one of your coaches up there.
Yeah, he recruited me out of high school. I guess what really, you know, when you were talking about schools, there was Cal, Utah State, Utah, Arizona State, a lot of the, you know, Midwest, West Coast schools.
Yeah.
So I was kind of in that era. And so when Rod Marinelli came to my high school, and, you know, I was being recruited pretty heavily, you know, he just was a great guy. I just kind of had this kindred spirit with him. You know, there's some people you just connect with, you know.
Right.
And he was one of those guys. He was a player's coach. And he just, you know, and the day I signed my letter of intent, University of California called me and told me, you know, I had a full ride if things didn't work out at Utah State, you know. But Rod was a big influence on my life, you know, that way. And then, you know, of course, you know, the brief time I spent in the league was a good experience. You know, I got to meet some guys and play with some guys that I used to watch in high school, and then I'm in the huddle with them. It's kind of surreal.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you played with some guys up there at Utah State that were, you know, NFL stars, you know, Rulon Jones, Eric Hipple, Bob Gagliano, Greg Cragen, I mean, you had some guys on that team that that really turned out to be NFL stars. Of course, you played for Coach Bruce Snyder.
Yeah, Bruce Snyder was a phenomenal coach, and, you know, he's passed away a few years ago. But he was a great coach. You know, Merlin Olsen played at Utah State, you know, and he was all pro, fearsome, foursome with the Rams. You know, he was on Monday Night Football and FTD Flowers. And, of course, he had an acting career at Little House on the Prairie and all that. And so when he called my house one time during the recruiting process, and my mom, as much as I played sports, you think my mom would know something about sports? She didn't know anything. She just came to she just come to the games and, you know, cheer and, you know, read a magazine. But he called my house. Merlin Olsen had called my house. They were recruiting in the Southern California area, and he called my house in for Utah State. And so my mom didn't know who Merlin Olsen was. And at that time in the late 70s, you know, it hadn't been long. He wasn't out of football that long.
Right.
And then he was doing Monday Night Football then. And so he calls my house, and my mom goes, "Honey, there's a guy on the phone named Merlin." And she goes, "What's your name again?" "Merlin Olsen." "Oh, okay." "Oh, my God." You know, so anyway. He was a big influence on me, you know. And I'm still friends with his brother to this day.
Okay.
Him and my dad were good friends. And so we're still friends to this day. Of course, Merlin's passed away, too.
Right.
But a lot of great memories. A lot of cool stuff. But getting back to your question, how did I get into wrestling? It was by accident. I was, you know, I'm from North Carolina, and when I was done with the Niners and got released after my injury, I just said, I'm going to go back to North Carolina and just visit family. You know, I hadn't seen my grandparents in a few years, and, you know, and of course I'm a different kid now. You know, I'm 6'5", 280, 90 pounds, right?
Right.
When I left, I was, you know, 13, 14 years old, so. You know, I'm in my early 20s now. So I go back, and I spent about a month there, you know, and I don't know if you've ever heard of Nelson Royal.
Oh, yeah, I remember Nelson Royal, legend.
Well, Nelson was the reason I got into the business. I was a friend of mine, I'm not a friend, an acquaintance that I knew, had a sporting goods store. And the guy goes, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I'm going to take a year off, travel, you know, just kind of see what I want to do with the rest of my life, you know." And in the meantime, he goes, "You ought to wrestle." I said, "Are you kidding me, wrestle?" And he goes, "Yeah, you ought to look into it. You'd be perfect for it. You got that look and you're tall and whatever." I said, "Well, I've never really thought about it as a career, you know, but, I'll talk." He said, "Well, I got a guy you need to meet. You need to meet Nelson Royal. He's got a Western store in Mooresville, North Carolina. And I think you guys hit it off." So I went over and he introduced me to Nelson. And me and Nelson Royal became really good friends. And kind of one thing led to another. And he said, "Have you ever thought about this business?" And I said, "You know, I haven't, but, you know, I'm kind of intrigued by it. I'm not married. You know, I didn't have any kids at the time. I'm single. I got nothing else to do, right?" So he said, "I can train you and I'll introduce you to Dusty and all this." So, that's kind of, without being too long winded, that's kind of how I got into the business. And Nelson had a ring and a barn out there on his property there. And so that's how I got trained. It wasn't the wrestling schools like they have now,
right?
Advanced and stuff. It was hardcore, no heat in the winter, and no air conditioning in the summer. It's 110 degrees in that barn, and we're in there training and, you know, taking bumps and doing all that crazy stuff.
What was it like meeting Dusty for the first time?
Well, you know, what was so funny is Dusty, he's a phenomenal, he was a phenomenal guy, really. Became pretty close with him, and I was kind of his work in progress, you know.
Right.
He would have me come to the matches and during the TV tapings, and he'd have me watch. Didn't want me to wrestle. He just wanted me to observe, get a feel for the guys and what's going on and all this. And little by little, you know, as I was training, Nelson was kind of telling him, "Okay, he's getting close to being ready to get in the ring." And so then Dusty had came up with an idea. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. They call them dark matches. And
back then,
you know, we'd film it, you know, in Rock Hill, South Carolina, you know, and in these arenas and you know, the high schools. And there was about a 30-minute lull during the TV taping where they would have to case tapes or do whatever to get ready for the second half of the show and get all those matches lined up. And So there was some dead time there. So they didn't want the people to just kind of get up and wander off. So they came up with the idea, let's send Todd out there in the dark match and see what he's got. And that's, you know, and so they throw me out there for 20 minutes or so. And it was a training session is what it was, in front of a crowd. And as my skill grew, you know, I started over time developing a little following. I wasn't on TV yet, but I was at every TV match. They had me come. And I started to develop a little following. You know, people started recognizing me. I thought, this is weird because I'm not even on television yet, you know. And I wasn't using the name Todd Champion at the time because Dusty hadn't thought of it yet because he's the one that gave me that name. And so, to make a long story short, I probably wrestled in dark matches for about 6 months. And Dusty, I came into one of the TV tapings one night. Dusty was coming on to talk to you. And he pulls me over to the side. He goes, look, man, he said, I've been thinking about it. He said, I'm going to change your name to Todd Champion. It's got a nice ring to it. Okay. That's your new name. Yeah. And that's kind of how Todd Champion, you know, was born. And I guess really the match that really kind of got me over or put me over with the fans, I'd been wrestling maybe a year, you know, and I was traveling, you know, and I was what we call the curtain jerker, you know.
Right.
I was the first guy out there, you know. But, you know, that's an important...
Yeah, that sets the tone for everything.
Exactly. And that's what he told me, because, look, kid, you know, so Dusty Rhodes would talk like this, you know. He says, okay, kid, I need you to go out there and do your thing, get these people going. We got a long night ahead of us, you know, and that's what he'd tell me. I said, okay, yes, sir. So I get out there and do my thing. And I started, you know, and your confidence builds over time, you know, and you learn what you can do. I didn't have a finishing move, so Dusty comes up with the backwards elbow, and that was kind of his brainchild for me to do as a finishing hold. And so one thing led to another. I walk into a TV taping one night, and there's usually a list on the wall of what order of matches you're going to be in. And And I looked, and my name was all the way at the bottom, and I was wrestling Ric Flair for the TV title.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Wow.
I said, what am I? I said, and I went, Dusty. I said, are you kidding me? He goes, no, you'll be fine, kid. You'll be fine. Just relax. You know? And, you know, the heading was champion versus champion, you know? So then he tells Ric Flair who his partner's going to be match that night. Flair's like, really? Dusty? You're going to be killed?
How did that go? Everybody I've talked to this wrestling player said it was like a night off.
Oh, my God. I was probably more, I got so nervous that I was so tired to get to the room. All my adrenaline was flowing. You know, and I watched Flair do his thing, you know, for about a year in person, you know, and behind the scenes. I'm like, man, this guy just, it's hard. When you got a guy like that whose craft is so perfected, you know, and I'd never wrestled anybody like that, because most of the guys that I was working with were undercard guys, you know?
Right.
And they were training me, teaching me, you know, so I'd never worked with that next step up in talent, you know? And so I walk over and I said, Rick, it's you and me tonight. He goes, yeah, that's what I heard. and then he told me, he said, look, kid, he said, just relax. Just relax and listen to me. We'll have a great match. I said, okay. And so I kind of put my confidence in. Everybody was telling me, and, you know, the other guys are going, look, man, just, you'll be fine, man. This is, like you said, a night off. He said, you're going to go in there and, like, feel like you're Superman. I said, okay, we'll see. I've never done this before with this guy.
Well, yeah.
And so we had this match, and we tore the house down. And Mr. Ric Flair was, he's a phenomenal professional. At his craft, and you know that's what, you know, I think some people forget that this is an art. This is an art form.
Yes, sir.
And you know, when you wrestle a guy like Ric Flair, who has been there, done that, got the t-shirt, earned all the respect of everybody he's ever wrestled, and you get in the ring and you actually, you know, he makes you look like $1 million bucks. I'm a green pea still, man. I'm still just trying to figure it out, and he made me look like $1 million. And we tore the house down. It was a 30-minute match on television, 35 minutes, whatever it was. And that kind of launched my career after wrestling. Even though I didn't win the match, that launched my career and that kind of, you know, really gave me the confidence to get out there and do what I did.
Right. So you had how was it like working for the Crocketts?
I enjoyed it. I mean, they were always nice to me. Never had a problem. I mean, you know, I didn't know, you know, you got to remember, I didn't really know that much. I was living in California, so wrestling wasn't a thing there. So I didn't know the territories and all that. I was just learning there were different territories, places you could go, and this was my first crack at this business, you know. It's kind of, you know, feast or famine, so to speak. And so they were always nice to me. They, you know, they were just gentlemen. They were professionals. Never, you know, they were just nice guys, man. And you know, they're human like everybody else.
Yeah.
But I can't say anything negative about them. They were always positive, always, you know, good match. You know, I'd come back and I didn't think I had a good match, and they were about there patting me on the back. Hey, man, you did fine. Don't worry about it. You're good. Don't worry about it. You know, so they kept me going. You know, so they were great guys, and I got great memories of going to that office over there in Charlotte. Watching cut interviews, you know, and, you know, watching Dusty, you know, do his magic. Because Dusty Rhodes was a genius, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He was so creative. You know, this was a guy that was doing things, you know, back then that, you know, they're still doing today. You know, when I watch some of the shows, you know, and watch the wrestling when I get a minute, you know, I see a lot of Dusty's influence in all this stuff that's going on now.
Yes, sir. Definitely. One of my favorite things back then was one of my favorite times was Great American Bash 86 when y'all did that whole tour. What was it like being on the road and doing that Great American Bash tour that year in 86?
Oh, God, I'm going to have to dust off the cobwebs in my brain cells for that one.
Yeah.
86. Well, Sam Houston and I were kind of got to be buddies because we were like the young guys in the group, you know, and kind of some up and coming young talent, you know, and all this. So we kind of hung around together, you know. So being on that, the Great American Bash, you know, Magnum TA and I became really good friends too. And, you know, when he had his accident, you know, when he broke his neck, that was tragic. I was with Magnum the night before that happened.
Oh, wow.
Because he was strong. He just bought that car. And we were in Charlotte. We just went and had dinner and stuff. And then the next day, you know, he had that tragic accident. But the Great American Bash was phenomenal. You know, you the best of the best. You know, and I don't know if it's David Allen Coe.
David Allen Coe, yeah.
Yeah, he was on that tour with us, I think, in 86.
Right.
And got a chance to meet him because they would always play. His concert was after the matches. So we were lucky enough to, you know, after the shows and all that, then he came on and he would sing and put on a concert. So we got to hang out and meet some of those guys. So it was a lot of fun. It was kind of grueling, I must say.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Night after night after night. And that's what people, you know, people watching who are not, you know, wrestling fans or they're not athletes, they don't understand, you know, the caliber of athletes that do this business and the grind it takes on your body. And it's not seasonal. It's year-round. And you're on the road every night, you know, in a different hotel. It's not glamorous. I mean, you're on a hotel every night. And then when that bell rings, you got to bring it. You got to bring your A-game. And the bash and all that was, you know, it was fun. It was, you know, it's new to me, you know.
Right.
A lot of guys did this before. I was kind of just the wide-eyed rookie, you know. Thinking, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah,
I was as big a fan as I was a wrestler,
right?
You know, and so that's probably I had this kind of childlike, I don't know, gratitude towards it. You know, so I, you know, the bash was a blast. You know, I had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah. So then the Crocketts, I guess they buy Central States Wrestling, and they end up sending you out there. You end up teaming up with a guy named DJ Peterson and winning the Central State Champions with the Thunderfoots. What was it like out in Central State? What was the difference between Central States and wrestling in Mid-Atlantic?
Well, that was a territory that they wanted to get going, right?
Right.
So they sent a crew out there, and we were one of them. And so they sent us out there, and it was a hard territory. because they were fighting, you know, and, you know, this is behind the scenes stuff. You know, the promoters were still not working together. You know, there was some animosity. And so when Crockett would come in and they'd send stuff to us, say, this is what you want to do, the promoters there would kind of try to sabotage it. And it was hard. It made it hard on all the guys because we're trying to out there do our job. And meanwhile, there's this political fighting going on, you know, which isn't everything. But
right.
That was probably my toughest gig because I was there for 6 months. And I and I don't know if you've ever been out the Midwest. There ain't no trees out there. when you're driving from St. Louis to wherever you're going, it's just straight ribbon highway, no trees. No nothing, and each gig was a minimum 200 miles, 300, 500, 600. I mean, it was a drive. We were driving these things. We weren't flying. We were driving. And so then Dusty and those guys would come in on one of the bigger house shows, and that was fine. That was tough. The Central States was a good learning experience. That's another learning experience for me, you know, going into a different territory, trying to build it. You know, and draw a crowd. Maybe some nights there'd only be 200 people there.
Yeah.
And you just drove four hours.
Wow. You know? They end up putting the tag belts on you and DJ Peterson. You guys get the win over Thunderfoots. And I was looking at your matches, and one of the matches that you guys defended the titles against ended up being a pretty impressive win. But, not, you know, at the time, they weren't the Powers of Pain, but they were the Barbarian and the Warlords. You guys had a win over them. They went on to be the Powers of Pain, but early Barbarian, right, early Warlord. How was it working with those guys?
They're great guys. I mean, I love Barbie and the Warlord. Barbie was hilarious. I mean, you know, he's stuck. You know, you see this massive human standing there. You know,
yeah.
And you look at him, go, man, he's gonna rip my freaking head off, and just. You know, and just the nicest guy, just very soft-spoken, in the ring, he was as light as a feather. I mean, the guy was the consummate professional. The Warlord was kind of green like me.
Yeah, that was by the time he started then.
Yeah, he was a little bit stiff. We had to coach him up a little bit. And look, man, you don't have to, you know, rip my head off every time because we got to work again.
So you one of the things that went on back then that you don't see now and kind of went down after after 87 or 88, the bunkhouse stampedes. Now you got to win in one of those bunkhouse stampedes in Des Moines, Iowa. What how brutal was that in those bunkhouse stampedes?
Well, you know, you're bringing up stuff I forgot, man. Man, you really did your research.
I tried to do my research.
Send me the notes on this when you're done. I can't remember half of them. That's awesome. Yeah, you know, that was one of those another first time thing for me. You know, not really knowing. You know, you got a bunch of guys in the ring, and you learn and you make mistakes and you move on. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, you know, you have to wear your jeans and cowboy boots and T-shirts, and that was kind of nice. But it was physical because there's a lot of guys in there and all these different things. But I enjoyed it. Well, you know, every time I did something, it was a learning experience. These are all first time gigs for me.
Yeah.
So, you know, learning from the guys that are in there and the old pros that have been around for a while. And you pick up little things, you know, and I'd watch them and try to learn and try to do what they do, you know, because that's how you learn. Yeah. But, yeah, it was pretty physical match. Yeah. And that's what I loved about what we did versus the other companies like the WWF. We were a more physical type of wrestling, which if you looked at our company and then you looked at the WWF at the time, they were more show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So you had your fans that liked the physicality of what we did, then you had the fans that liked what they did. So that was kind of the difference. And we kind of, you know, as you know, guys like me and Barbie and those guys, we kind of prided ourselves on our physicality of it all.
Yeah.
Because we wanted people to come, when they came to watch this match, they saw a physical match. They didn't see the fluff and puff and stuff. They saw a bunch of physical guys getting it done. And that's what we kind of prided ourselves on.
Yeah, and then then you go to the another. You know, I'm bringing up things that there was so much, and most of the Crockett stuff I love. Like I told you before, the Crockett Memorial Cup in '87. You and Denny Brown team up, and the first round you guys kind of played the spoiler. You ended Mulkey Mania at the Crockett Cup. They got their first win prior to the Crockett Cup, but you guys go out there and take them out in the first round and then end up losing to the Japanese team in the second round. But how was that experience with the Crockett Cup?
That was, like I said, that's another first-timer for me. But, yeah, it was great. It was, you know, when you have these different events like this, they all kind of bring on their own special flavor, if I can say that.
Yeah.
They all have their own kind of, these events have their own personality. So the leading up to the Crockett Cup, you know, being green and learning, you know, I was just happy to be there and, you know, seeing the guys and seeing some guys that I'd never seen. You know, we'd never wrestled the Japanese guys before.
Right.
That was the first time. So that was kind of my first taste of wrestling somebody other than who's in the company, you know, every day. So that was a learning experience for me, and that actually got me into Japan, that match did, when I went to Japan a couple years later.
Yeah.
So the Crockett Cup was phenomenal.
Yeah, I got to ask you this. Midnight Express.
Uh-huh.
Eaton and Lane or Eaton and Condry? Which one did you prefer more? You wrestled both of them now. You wrestled Eaton and Condry and Eaton and Lane.
Yeah. I love Bobby to death, too.
Yeah, Bobby, one of the most underrated wrestlers out there.
Oh, my God. And just a phenomenal guy, too, just as a person. Probably, you know what? I really can't say. They were both good.
Yeah.
Condry and Lane were both good. I mean, they both brought something to that, you know, the Midnight Express. They brought their own kind of style to that tag team. And so, really, they were both, like I said, consummate professionals. I can't really make a call on that.
Got you. That's a tough question there. But you wrestled some guys that, you know, that were on the way up. You wrestled legends, of course. The Four Horsemen, you got to work with them, like we talked about, Ivan Koloff, Nikita. And then you go to the UWF, and you get to work against these two young guys, Rick Steiner and Sting. What was it like working with those two guys?
Well, it was different, because we were in their green, too.
Yeah.
But it was, it was a learning experience for all of us, to be honest with you. We were all in there, you know. We're all in there, you know, when you get in that business, you want to make a name for yourself, right?
Right.
So that's what we were in there for. But, you know, when you got four young guys in there trying to kind of get a foothold in the business where you got to make a name for yourself, you know, we did what we had to do. And those guys were great. I mean, Sting's a good guy. He's a California guy anyway.
That's right.
So we both kind of had the same stomping grounds out there. I'm surprised I never ran into him at all the gyms that I work out, because we worked out a lot of the same clubs. And, you know, the Steiners are the Steiners. You know, what are you going to say?
Yeah. So your days with the Crockett's come to an end in '87. But you – and I have done my research. You remember wrestling a dark match for the WWF?
Yes.
And Winston-Salem against Barry Horowitz. How was that? How did that come about?
Well, I got a call, because after that, I just, you know, I wasn't sure I was going to wrestle anymore, and they called me and said, hey, will you come and wrestle a dark match? You know, Vince wants to see you in a match. It's okay. So I went up there, and Barry Horowitz is a great guy, and we had a great match, and, you know, nothing really came of it, to be honest with you.
Right.
I don't know if I was timing. You know, because sometimes timing's everything. Sometimes you're in there at the right time, sometimes you're not. And so after I had that match, I never really heard from anybody after that. So I just said, you know what, I'm just going to move on, do some other things, and then kind of let it go at that point.
Yeah, then you end up in All Japan Wrestling. And you talked about how your match at the Crockett Cup kind of led to that. But you end up teaming up with a guy that is a legend, and another guy that his name doesn't get mentioned enough, Terry Bam Bam Gordy, member of the Freebirds.
Yeah.
You end up teaming with him a lot over there in Japan.
Yeah.
How was it teaming with him?
I love Terry because, you know, he's just a big old country boy but knows what he's doing in the ring. And I'd never been in Japan before, so he had to kind of coach me up because a lot of these guys don't speak English. So,
yeah.
So I just, whatever Terry told me to do, I did, you know, because I didn't know what else to do. So we went in there, and I think our first match was in the Tokyo Dome. And he was telling me, he said, "This is, you know, these guys, you know, you, if they don't sell, you got to make them sell." And I was like, "Really?" So he gets in the ring. Yeah, oh yeah. And I'm like, "Really?" And so I watched, I found one of my old matches, and that was probably the most physical matches I had had. And I was, and he told me, he said, "Don't you lighten up, you lay them in there, because they're going to lay them into you." And sure enough, man, we had one of those matches where it just looked like a brawl. You know?
Yeah.
It didn't look like a wrestling match. It looked like a brawl. It looked like we were at a bar somewhere, and I was, you know, we were just throwing haymakers every chance at the guy.
Another guy you teamed up with over there a few times is Shane Douglas. What was it like working with Shane? This was before ECW, so he had a little bit different look then.
Right. Shane's good dude. Very athletic. Shoot, we had a blast. So he was, when you work with different partners, you got to kind of learn what they do.
Right.
And kind of adapt. And if you don't adapt, then the tag team doesn't function properly. So, Shane was athletic. You know, he was the high flyer guy, you know. So I had to kind of adapt what I was doing from me and Terry being, you know, just slugfest, you know, hardcore, you know, take them down, ride on, you know, to some high spots.
Right.
You know. and so, you know, all the stuff. So he was more of a high spot guy. So I had to change the way I did things to, you know, complement what he was doing. And he did things for me too. So it was a complimentary thing. But he was a great guy, you know, very athletic, good looking kid, you know, young kid,
yeah.
You know, and a great wrestler in his own right.
So, and then you take, you know, maybe a year and a half. You don't really see Ty champion around, but all of a sudden, WCW, you get a comeback and you team up with a guy named Curtis Thompson, but he's known as Firebreaker Chip, and you guys are known as the WCW Patriots. Who got in contact with you guys to bring you back to WCW?
Dusty.
That's kind of what I figured. I'd never heard, but that's kind of what I figured.
Yeah. What was funny was I went back to California and I got into the movie business a little bit there.
Right.
And I had my Screen Actors Guild card in Hollywood. So I did, you know, bit parts in Tango and Cash, Rocky V. I did some L.A. Laws. I did Matlock, met Andy Griffith a couple times. And so I was on the set, what was the name, Tango and Cash. And it was about a two-week filming thing where I played a prisoner in prison, and me and Stallone have a fight scene. He kicks me through a table, you know, and all that. So I was doing that, and I got home one night, and it was back when we had answering machines. We didn't have cell phones, or did we?
I don't think. Anyway. If they were, they were expensive. I don't know what then.
Yeah. So I get a call, and Dusty goes, "Todd Champion, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I just got through." He said, "What are you doing in the movie?" I said, "Well, shoot, I got to do something." He starts laughing. He goes, "Look, I got an idea for you." And he kind of laid it out for me what, you know, they were thinking. In the beginning, the Patriots were going to be, there were going to be four of us. There was going to be a fireman, an army guy, which that's what I was, a policeman, and an astronaut.
Right.
And then Turner was thinking about making it a cartoon, like a kid's cartoon.
All right.
And that's kind of how it all starts. So Dusty was laying this out for me. And I said, "Well, Dusty, I don't know. You know, what's the money like?" He said, I'll make sure the money's right for you. I promise. It'll be a guaranteed money. There's sometimes you won't wrestle for 4 days, you're still getting paid. I said, "Okay."
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so I flew back there and met with him the first time. And he goes, "You know, I got this guy named Curtis. Here's what we're thinking. I'm going to bring you guys in. We're going to have a meeting in a few days with the corporate guys in CNN and or Turner Entertainment, and we're going to pitch this idea to them." You know, and back when I was wrestling with the Crockett's, we didn't do anything like that, you know?
Right.
We didn't have to pitch. Yeah, Dusty kind of thought of it. We created it, and we went out and did it. Well, now it's gone corporate. you know.
Yeah.
And now you're sitting in a boardroom with the board of directors with guys with ties on and stuff, you know.
But big difference.
Brings us in. Yeah, big difference. So when he brought us in, he had me standing up there and Curtis standing up there. That's when I met Curtis for the first time. And anyway, so we pitched, you know, he says, I want this guy, I want him to, you know, they're going to call the Patriots and we're going to do this. And this is what I see them doing as a, you know, marketing tool and all this stuff. And so that's kind of how the Patriots were born.
Right. Well, you guys get a pretty big push from the start, too. I mean, you guys were impressive, but you go out there, you get some world tag team title shots against Arn Anderson, Larry Zbyszko. You make it to the semifinals and end up losing in the semifinals of a tag team tournament to Anderson and Zbyszko. But what was it like, and I didn't ask you this a while ago when we talked about your first time with the Crockett. What was it like working with Arn Anderson?
Night off. Arn's probably about the funniest dude. You know, when you know, his persona is a real hard ass.
Right.
But you talk about a consummate professional. Probably about the wittiest dude I've ever met in my life. The guy can have you rolling on the floor laughing, and make fun of you 1 minute, and have you, you know, laughing at yourself the next. I mean, it's hilarious. But when you get in the ring with guys like Arn Anderson, Larry Zbyszko, I mean, these guys have been doing it. Got the t-shirt, you know, they know what they're doing. So I knew we were going to have good matches with those guys. I knew that they, you know, they were going to call the match. We were going to listen. We were going to do our thing, but they were going to guide us through that. And those guys, you know, like I said, this day, I got nothing but mad respect for them, man. And, I miss those days, man. I miss the days of the Crockett. Well, I'm jumping back a little bit in the Crockett's when we'd all be in the same car together and have to pull over a gas station, pick up, you know, some beer and stuff, and then they'd make me drive because I was the rookie. They'd go, okay, rookie, you're driving, and then they'd sit in the back seat to play cards and do whatever, and I got stuck driving everywhere, but that was okay.
Yeah. So some of the guys, now that you mentioned that, who were the guys you rode up and down the road with the most?
Oh my gosh, man. Well, let's see. You remember the Italian Stallion?
I remember him very well. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Gary, Boogie Woogie Man, he and I kind of hit it off, but he'd always want to ride with me, or I'd rent the car, and let's put it this way, he never drove, he slept everywhere, he was the consummate, hey brother, I'll pay for your gas, if you just drive, okay, I'll drive, and I'd look over 5 minutes later, he's asleep. But, you know, guys like that, you know, the Italian Stallion and myself, me and Sam Houston, you know, the guys in the Central States area.
Right.
You know, we all go, you know, Gene Ligon, I don't know if you know who he is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did an interview with Mr. Ligon.
Gene and I were really good friends, and Gene would come in the ring and train with us, and of course, he was one of the Thunderfoots as well.
Right.
So, you know, all those guys, you know, I'll tell you a funny story. It was me and the Italian Stallion and Boogie Woogie, and I can't remember who else in the car. And they were playing cards, and they had the dome light on. And we were in South Carolina somewhere, and we were coming home to Charlotte. It was late. It was probably, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm kind of tired. And we're all driving, and they got this dome light on in the back. Well, it was foggy, and Gary had rented this car, and I was driving it. And I ran a stop sign. It was out in the country, you know. I ran a stop sign, slid across the road, ran through a barn fence into a field.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, you got stories like that. Then we were talking about the Great American Bash. And, you know, my dad was a pastor out in California, and he loved wrestling. He was an old school guy.
Right.
And so he was at one of our matches when we were in Fulton County Stadium. It was an outdoor thing. And so we're going back to Charlotte, and Robert Gibson comes over, and Ricky goes, hey, man, are you flying back? You drive? I said, I'm driving back because I'll get home faster. He goes, can we ride with you? I said, absolutely. Come on. So it was me and my dad, Rock and Roll Express, and those guys. Because we would get, you know, by the time those guys got dressed, went to the airport, sat around waiting for a plane, we were already in Charlotte, and they were just to get, you know. So we made it in like 3 hours, or about 3.2 hours. I think we were flying down the road. But So, you know, guys like that. And Ricky and Robert were great friends. You know, Manny Fernandez, Reggie Foles, good guy. He would always pull me off the side and say, that was good, but you need to do this and this and this. You know, so you get that kind of input from the older guys that have been around because, you know, let's face it, we're the ones down the road to be wrestling when these guys are retired. So they want that legacy to keep going.
That's right.
So you know, a lot of guys like that. And Manny was a lot. He was a car rider with us a lot, too.
Okay.
So he was good. And I used to fly Ronnie Garvin. He's a pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah, hands of stone. So sometimes, you know, Ronnie loved to fly his little plane everywhere. And he'd go, hey, kid, you want to ride? You want to fly down to this thing? I said, well, how much? He says, $100. You fly with me. We'll get in, fly, and fly back. And so I'd fly with Ronnie Garvin and Jimmy. Jimmy was a pilot, too.
Yeah.
And so they'd get these little jumper planes. We'd jump on these little jumper planes, and we'd get to a match and, you know, go and jump back in the plane instead of driving home like we'd be, say, here in Atlanta. And it takes 3.5 hours to get from, you know, Atlanta to Charlotte. We'd jump in that little pipe, little four-seater plane and be home an hour and 20 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
So we'd do stuff like that. So that was a lot of the road stuff.
Yeah, so getting back to the WCW, you guys end up beating the Freebirds for the U.S. Tag Team titles. You get the titles in your hands. And what was it like working with those guys, with Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin?
Well, you know, that I'll never forget that night because we were in the Gainesville Coliseum here in Georgia.
Right.
And I had a Corvette at the time. And I had it when I was playing ball and I was driving it around, you know. And so Curtis, you know, in his infinite wisdom, Curtis was hilarious. I love Curtis to death. So I had a polo green Corvette, right? So I pull up into the Gainesville Arena. We didn't know that night they were going to put the straps on. So they didn't tell us. It was kind of a surprise.
Right.
And so I pull up and I get out and all of a sudden I see this white Corvette come barreling around the corner, burning rubber, pulls in beside me and he gets out. He bought himself a Corvette. So here we are. I went, what did you do? He said, man, you got one? I said, I got to get me one of these things. He was a nut, man. He was a nut. But Russ, going back to your question, those guys were just phenomenal. Got there, did not know that they were going to put the straps on us. Because we were having some good, you know, one of our first tag team matches, since you did all this research on them, maybe you missed us when we wrestled the Ring Lords on TV. Did you see that one?
The Ring Lords?
The Ring Lords, yeah. That was our first official tag team match.
Okay. I didn't see that because, yeah, they don't have that one listed up here in my research.
Yeah, that's fine. No, that's fine. But it's on YouTube. It's fun because and I'll never forget because we had not really worked as a tag team yet. We weren't wrestling, but we weren't working as a tag team yet. We were just signing autographs and we had the best gig in the world. And one night they said, okay, you're on it. You have music and here's all your stuff. You know, we didn't even have music yet, you know, entry music. So getting back to that, you know, wrestling was, and then it kind of took off from there. And then, like you said, the big push. Then we were wrestling with Freebird that night in Gainesville. And it was another night off with those guys.
Yeah.
Those guys were just phenomenal. I just, you know, Michael and Jimmy, they do their thing. They had us do our thing, you know, then they put straps on us, and that's pretty much how we ran with it.
Yeah. And you guys end up wrestling some guys that went on to be legendary Hall of Fame wrestlers in the old mind. Guys like Big Van Vader, and then a guy that was a little different back. Two guys that were a little different back then. Steve Austin, who was Stunning Steve Austin, not Stone Cold.
Yeah.
And Oz,
yeah,
which was Kevin Nash. He also wrestled Vinny Vegas with Kevin Nash. What was it like wrestling those three guys?
Well, you know, it was funny that you said that because I was watching somebody, you know, I'm in the car business and I'm in business development. And so every time I go to a dealership and they don't know who I am, they Google me.
Right.
And those matches always come up. I mean, me and Stunning Steve, we had two matches for TV titles in I think it was 91. And he's the same. He just had hair back then.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, he was something to watch. I remember going to a live event and seeing that guy with that long ponytail And I was like, wow, this guy's pretty good. And, you know, WCW really just didn't know how to use him, obviously. So at that time, they didn't know how to use him, I'll put it that way. But, wow. Yeah. And then you wrestle, you know, Kevin Nash, who was Oz, and Vinny Vegas at the time. What was it like with you?
Those guys, great match. You know, Kevin's a great guy. And, like, he was a little green at the time, you know?
Yeah.
And so when we had that match, I had to kind of think about things and make sure, you know, we did things the right way. But, you know, he was green, but he was, you know, he was doing his thing, and I was doing mine. And super nice guy. I mean, those guys were, you know, it's funny because, you know, sometimes egos get in the way in this business. You know, some guys don't like each other for whatever reason. But we didn't have that problem. The younger guys, we were just happy to be there, you know. We were just happy to be in the ring. We were just happy to have a match and, you know, and do something that, you know, because how many people can do have a job that they actually love doing, you know. And we loved our jobs, and so we just did the best we could with what we had.
So you finish up your time with WCW. You end up going to the USWA. Now, how did that come about? You end up in the USWA?
Probably by accident, like everything else has happened so far.
These are good accidents that keep happening to you.
I know. I keep falling into this stuff. I don't know what's going on. I got a call, and they said, would you consider coming here? Because I was actually kind of, I got engaged, you know, I was thinking about, you know, maybe having a family and wrestling's not going to go good together, you know. So I kind of, I'd opened up my own gym here in Atlanta called Todd Champions All-Pro Athletic Club. So I was running the club, kind of doing that, and then I get this phone call, and they said, would you come and do a program with Jerry Lawler? And I said, yeah, well, what's the deal? Well, they wanted me to turn heel there.
Yeah.
So I've never been a heel before, so now I've got to put on a different cap, you know. And so got in there and had some good matches with that in the Mid-South and working with Jerry and Jeff Jarrett, you know. And, you know, we had a couple matches, you know, where, you know, I beat him and then we had a return match and my manager had to be chained to Jeff Jarrett because he interfered and, you know, the whole storyline.
Burt Prentice.
And so, Burt Prentice, yeah. So, you know, it was fun. That was something I've always said, man, it seems like the heels have more fun than the baby faces do.
That was my next question. After that experience, would you rather been a heel or a baby face?
You know, I think I could have gone either way, but I sure did have a lot of fun not having to be nice.
I will put up that promo on my Facebook page, on the Ringside Rams page, of you and Burt Prentice. I think it's called "This Is Your Life, Todd Champion," and talking about all your accomplishments. That you did approve. I was, because that's the first time I'd seen that, and I was surprised how good of a heel you pulled off it with that.
Well, you know, it's so funny. We were, you know, it was, you know, I, like I said, I'm still a fan. When I went, you know, Jerry the King Lawler, he's a legend, right? So I'm a fan. So I'm like, hey, Jerry, he's going, hey, kid, how you doing? You know, just normal. And so I got there a few days early because I'm a big Elvis Presley fan.
Right.
So when I got to Memphis, I was engaged at the time. My fiance was with me, and I wanted to go. And we cut a couple little promos, but we hadn't really had our match yet in the South where, you know, the titles are going to change and all that. But it was building up to that. And so I'm just standing. I had a baseball cap on, some sweats, and I'm standing at ATM because I'm at Elvis Presley's house. So I'm going to go take the tour, you know, like everybody else does.
Right.
I was, you know, big Elvis fan. So I'm standing to get some money at the ATM, and I stand at the stoplight. I'm getting ready to walk, and a truck pulls up, slams on the brakes, and stops and look at me. And this guy rolls down his window, looks at me, and goes, "I hope you get Jerry Lawler's ass tonight." And it took off. My fiance looks at me and goes, "Are they serious?" I said, "They're very serious."
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
They're very serious. Then we had a match. We weren't in Memphis. We were, let me think. That's where I really got a lot of heat. I had to get a police escort for the freeway.
Wow.
we were in Johnson City, Tennessee, and my fiance was with me, and so she kind of went back with me, and then she kind of sat out in the bleachers, you know, to watch the match, right? And there's, you know, there's two cops in the back, and there's one that escorts to the ring. And we had me and Jim, we just tore the house down, and I just drew all kind of heat. I mean, more than I was expecting. I was getting booed at. There, people were throwing stuff at me. And during the match, about 5 minutes before the match was over, the policeman goes up and gets my fiance and says, "Hey, I need you to come over here and stand with me." And she's going, "Why?" "Because these people here are really mad. They know you're with Todd."
Oh, wow.
"I just don't want to, yeah, I don't want to see them turn on you." So she had to leave the arena and stand in the back with the police officer. And so after our match, I mean, it was just, we left it all out on the table. I mean, you know, with the chairs flying, the people and everything else, there were fights. And I get in the car, and the policeman goes, "I need you to follow me to the freeway and don't stop. You're about 50 miles out of here." I said, "Why?" He said, "There's a bunch of guys in this parking lot that want to beat, kick your ass." And my wife, my ex now, but my fiance looks at me and goes, "You really made those people mad." I said, "Well, I did my job."
You did your job. You did your job.
Yeah. So,
but you end up going back to WCW for a while, and you end up in a little feud with Steven Regal. I watched the promo this morning when you came back and talking about you were going to show the world that he was not Lord Steven Regal. He was just Steve Regal, and you had a couple good matches with him. But then you end up going back to Japan again. Why didn't you stay longer with WCW?
The company was just changing as fast as you could. There was no, you know, Dusty was gone.
Right.
The president, Bob, I can't remember his name now, he was fired. The whole company was changing. And I just didn't like the direction it was going.
Right.
You know?
And along with a lot of other people.
yeah. So I just felt like, you know what? I've got a degree. You know, I'm not a dumb guy. I can go get a different job. And even though I didn't want to, I just felt like it was time for me to. I don't want to be in something where I wasn't enjoying what I was doing anymore.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of like playing football. You watch guys that have long careers in the NFL, and after a while, they're only in it for the. They don't enjoy the game anymore. They're just getting a paycheck. That's all they're doing.
Yeah.
And then they bow out gracefully or whatever. So the company was just changing, going in a different direction. There was all kind of rumors flying. They were going to sell the company. They were going to shut it down. I just didn't want to be a part of that stress. You know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And that's why I kind of. Because nobody really, you know, the angles, they wouldn't stick with anything. You know, Steve Regal and myself, we could have ran that feud out for months, right?
Right.
Well, we had a couple matches, and they decided to do something else. And they had a couple matches. So nobody, they didn't stick with storylines long enough to make it, you know, make it worthwhile.
Yeah, and you tell me, and I don't know how much you watch of today, but the different there's a lot of difference, and I watch a little bit today, but I'll go back and watch YouTube or whatever I've got on my DVDs or whatever. I'd rather go back and watch, you know, the syndicated NWA with Crockett every Saturday night, like I used to watch. Then, because I think they have a trouble. Not saying that these guys aren't great athletes and they know what they're doing, they do, but the storytelling is not there. And just like you said, it's kind of started about that time where they didn't stick with storylines long enough to really get you into it. I mean, you had back then you had the Horseman versus Dusty that lasted for, I mean, you know, that lasted for a year on and off. But, you know, they'll go 2 or 3 weeks, and then next thing you know, the guys were feuding with each other or teaming up. And, I mean, I just don't think they do the storylines long enough to really get you into it.
Well, you know, like anything, things change, you know. But that's been probably, when I watch it now, you know, I'm not a critical watcher, but it just, they don't know how to physically tell a story anymore.
Yeah.
They gotta do all the talking before the match so people know what they're doing. We didn't do that back then when I was wrestling. That's what made this such an art form, you know, back in the day, was because, you know, guys like Jake the Snake.
He
could not touch. He could not touch a guy for 5 minutes in a ring and get more heat than anybody today doing, you know, all the high spots that they do.
No doubt.
Whatever they do.
No doubt.
And so you got to be able to physically, you know, Ric Flair said it's physical theater. It is. But what they you know, what you lose now is the guys in the ring, I guess the work is different. They're more high flying. It's almost Japanese-like, you know, because the Japanese like to fly all over the place. Back then, we would grab a hold and work that match, work that body part. That's how I was taught. My Nelson Royal told me, he said, you can have a match, a great 15, 20-minute match working just the arm if you know how to do it.
Yeah, exactly. No doubt.
And so, I, you know, and it's funny, when I was being trained, I didn't take one bump for like 3 months. All it was standing up, locking up, and working the arm, working the arm, working the arm, go back to the arm, get the arm, get the arm back, arm drag it back. That's how you did it. And now, you know, everybody's, you know, doing, you know, 18 flips in the air and, you know, very athletic, but it doesn't tell a story. It's just a lot of action, you know, so to speak. But they got to tell their story before they get there. It's just another match.
Yeah, then,
you know,
then you come back in 97 with Michinoku Pro as Perro Russo. How did that character come about?
That's a long story too. I wasn't planning on coming back, to be honest with you.
Right.
I didn't want to. And now I'm married, right? I got kids now,
right?
At this point. And I'm like, you know, should I do this? Should I not do this? My wife goes, you know what? Get it out of your system. That's what she told me. Go there, get it out of your system. And she said, and you'll know when you're done with your matches, when you're done with this deal, you'll know whether you want to stay with it or go back to the career you were working on. And so I did that. It came up with that gimmick for me. And when I was done, I just didn't have the passion that I had in the past years. You know, it was different.
Right.
You know, times are changing. It's the 90s now. You know, it's almost 2000. And, you know, storylines, like you said, and we were chatting earlier, just nothing seemed to deal. And, you know, I was married, you know, had kids now. I had a daughter, son, and trying to raise a family. And I just said, you know, I just lost my passion for it, you know. And I was more family-oriented at that point. And I said, you know, maybe this is it for me. Maybe this is, you know, it's kind of like football. You kind of know when it's time to get out.
Right.
Especially if you've been hurt a lot. Because, I had total knee construction on my right knee, playing ball and all this. And you kind of know when it's your time to bow out gracefully. So, you know, I just did that. I bowed out gracefully. I was thankful for the opportunities. I said, guys, I'll probably be back. I think I'm done.
Right.
And I just walked away.
Well, one more thing, one more match I have to mention before we stop talking. Now I ask you what you're up to now and stuff. There was a dark match, and we had two reunions that night. I guess a dark match on Nitro at Charlotte. The Patriots reunited to take on the Samoan SWAT team. Now, how did that come about on a Nitro dark match?
You know, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. It just happened. Now, it just, you know, we were on the tail end of our deal, too. You know, our contracts were coming out.
Right.
And we weren't sure if they were going to tag us anymore. We were doing, you know, the company was, like I said, that was the time, you know, starting to go into a different direction. And they were, you know, we were wrestling in a lot of singles matches. We weren't together that much.
Right.
So we got together on this one. You know, it was just another, you know, just they called and said, we want you to do this. Like, that's great. Fine, I'll do it. No biggie. And it was local and all that. I was close to home. So we got in there with those guys, and they were great guys. The SWAT, Sloan SWAT team were great guys. And that's kind of how we got into that one.
Yeah. When I was doing this research, I was kind of surprised to see that one. After all this time, y'all back together.
Right. And actually, Chris and I had talked about it, and we were kind of thinking, you know, maybe we ought to take the Patriots, but they had the rights to the Patriots, you know,
right.
Connor did. So we couldn't leave the company and take the name with us. So we were thinking, you know, we should, you know, kind of have that image, but, you know, change our name so we don't get sued by all the corporate lawyers. And so we thought about it and then said, let's just see how everything develops. And, you know, and then, like I said before, that's when everything was changing.
Right.
You know, wrestling was changing. And companies were doing whatever, and the storylines were very short. And nobody built, you know, they used to build, you know, they talk about building territories where they, they build the characters, they build the athletes, so people know them. It's a long-term affair. And like you said, it's 3 or 4 weeks, you're done. Next, you know, the next guy gets up, you know?
Yeah.
So the fans really, I think, if kids today were watching wrestling back when we were doing it, I think they'd be totally shocked at how we didn't do a lot of talking. We did a little talking, but we don't do near as much talking as they do now. And
no.
Because we told the story in the ring. We told the story in the ring.
Definitely, and I mean, that's what I missed the most about back then was you guys told the story in the ring, and you know, there was, like you said, there was some talking, but most time if you were guaranteed, even though the matches on those syndicated shows, I'm in a very, very small town back then and still live there today, but we had three channels and I didn't get TBS, but so I had to depend on WREL on the 11:30 and then 12 noon on a Virginia channel out of there. But you were guaranteed something was going to happen, and it was always exciting at the end of the show, especially at the end of the show. They always kept the exciting part at the end. But so you're through with wrestling now. So tell us what you're doing now. You talked a little bit about it earlier.
Yeah. I built my health club, you know, and I ran that for several years. And then I sold that, and I got into the car business.
Okay.
And became a finance manager. I went to finance school, did all that. And so I've been in the car business for about 20 years now. I'm in business development with Jim Ellis Automotive here in Atlanta. We own about 17 dealerships.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing, man. I'm doing a lot of internet sales things and websites and training. I train people, and you know, just I like to teach. I like to teach, so I teach these young folks how to do business the right way. You know.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. I got two more questions for you, and then I'll let you go. And I appreciate you taking your time. And this is kind of like quick hitting questions for you. And I know these are going to be tough for you. Favorite match, one that really, really stands out. And I know there's probably going to be a couple, maybe even more than a couple, but favorite match of your career?
As a tag team or single?
Well, you can do tag team and singles.
All right. Tag team match, probably the one that I enjoyed, I thought was as fun or much fun, was the Wideout Southern Boys.
Oh, yeah. Tracy's mother, Steve Armstrong.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That was one of our favorite tag team matches. That's one of them. I mean, I can name 10 or 12.
Oh, yeah,
but
I know you could.
Probably in singles, probably the Ric Flair match.
And I would definitely say, yeah, the Ric Flair match. Anytime you get in the ring with that guy. So
you can't have a bad match with him. It's just impossible.
favorite opponent that you went up against?
Favorite opponent? I'd say probably enjoyed to work with. God, there's so many guys, man. I hate to single one guy. So
well, if you want to say two or three, that is fine.
Okay, I'd say probably the old school Larry Zbyszko in a single.
Uh-huh.
Probably Arn Anderson. And probably Stone Cold Steve.
Okay. That's three good, really good ones there. And Arn Anderson is probably, I'll tell people this day, Arn Anderson is probably one of, if not my favorite, one of the favorite. Ric Flair and Arn Anderson are my two favorite wrestlers. But Arn is just, deserves a lot more credit than he gets. Just like Bobby Eaton, he deserves a lot more credit than he gets. Anyway, Mr. Champion, thank you so much for taking time. Well, I mean, we, like I told you before, I could talk about this stuff all night. We've been talking for an hour now. But, I have really enjoyed talking to you. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us tonight.
Hey, man, I really appreciate you having me on. And tell everybody out there, God bless everybody. Feel free to reach out to me again. I got more stories.
Oh, I sure will. I'm going to hold you to that now.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much. Guys, that is Todd Champion on Ringside Ramblings.